Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading, prepared by Jill Bevilacqua, and Michelangelo's fresco masterpiece. Join us on a virtual tour of the Sistine Chapel to learn more about the figure of St. John the Baptist, one of the many people depicted in the Renaissance artist's famous fresco of the Last Judgment, painted behind the chapel's altar. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus told his disciples this parable. The reign of God is like the case of the owner of an estate who went out at dawn to hire workmen for his vineyard. After reaching an agreement with them for the usual daily wage, he sent them out to his vineyard. He came out about mid-morning and saw other men standing around the marketplace without work, so he said to them, "You too, go along to my vineyard and I will pay you whatever is fair." At that they went away. He came out again around noon and mid-afternoon and did the same. Finally, going out in late afternoon, he found still others standing around. To these he said, "Why have you been standing here idle all day?" "No one has hired us," they told him. He said, "You go to the vineyard too." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workmen and give them their pay, but begin with the last group and end with the first." When those hired late in the afternoon came up, they received a full day's pay, and when the first group appeared, they supposed they would get more. Yet they received the same daily wage. Thereupon they complained to the owner, "This last group did only an hour's work, but you've put them on the same basis as us who've worked a full day in the scorching heat." "My friend," he said to one in reply, "I do you no injustice. You agreed on the usual wage, did you not? Take your pay and go home. I intend to give this man who was hired last the same pay as you. I am free to do as I please with my money, am I not? Or are you envious because I am generous? Thus the last shall be first, and the first shall be last."
Of all the occupations a man might follow, none is so often mentioned by our Lord in his parables as that of the worker in a vineyard. It must have been a very familiar image, as we're told that in the Old Testament, the vineyard was the established figure of Israel, God's chosen people, and the Lord of the vineyard was God. Isaiah writes of the vineyard of Yahweh.
Sing of the delightful vineyard. I, Yahweh, am its keeper. Every moment I water it, for fear its leaves should fall. Night and day I watch over it. I am angry no longer. If thorns and briars come, I will declare war on them. I will burn them every one. Or if they would shelter under my protection, let them make their peace with me.
In Advent, we read Isaiah's celebrated vision of everlasting peace, explained in the Missal by this note: "The Lord will gather all nations together into the eternal peace to form the kingdom of God." The prophet Micah echoes these words of Isaiah, but after the first familiar lines, he adds something of his own.
"They will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into sickles. Nation will not lift sword against nation. There will be no more training for war. Each man will sit under his vine and his fig tree, with no one to trouble him."
These words must have been familiar to the people of Shakespeare's time, for he echoes Micah in the speech made by Archbishop Cranmer to King Henry VIII, prophesying a reign of peace when his newly born daughter Elizabeth shall come to the throne.
In her days, every man shall eat in safety under his own vine what he plants, and sing the merry songs of peace to all his neighbours.
We might today wonder that Englishmen should be cultivating vines in what is hardly an ideal climate. But they did, and at Hampton Court, the magnificent country house on the bank of the River Thames, which Cardinal Wolsey presented to Henry VIII in a desperate attempt to regain his favour, you can go and see the great vine, which was planted in 1769, the oldest vine in England. Its roots are supposed to have reached the river 60 feet away. And in its heyday, it produced over 2,000 bunches of grapes a year. But by the 20th century, it was bearing less than half the number, and these were sold for charity. Throughout the centuries, then, the vine and vineyard have been a part of everyday life, likewise the symbolism. But when we listen to today's parable, which has been described as one of the most disconcerting, we're invariably perplexed, and yes, disconcerted. Automatically, we side with the men who have worked a full day in the scorching heat and complain because they don't receive more than those who've only worked an hour. But, comments a biblical scholar, the parable is not intended to present a model of trade union practice. As with so many, if not all, the parables, we have to try and put aside our preconceptions, our prejudices, our ideas of justice, and all the impedimenta of our modern mentality, and our calculating worldly way of interpreting a hypothetical situation. But let's say for a moment that we're looking at a real one. It's vintage time, and the owner of a vineyard wastes no time but goes out at dawn to hire day labourers. And he knows he'll find them. And indeed, there they are in the marketplace, where it was the custom in the East for those seeking work to wait, in the hope of finding it. Every day would be the same for the casual labourer. Each new dawn would bring fresh hope that today would be better than yesterday. Dawn can be so different for different people. For some, it can bring a sense of relief after a sleepless night. For others, it means the return of problems, perhaps of pain. Others again greet the new day with joy, with anticipation. And to be up and about at early-like can bring its own rewards and surprises, as Irish poet Seamus Heaney discovered.
Travelling south at dawn, going full out through high-up stone-wall country, the rocks still cold, rainwater gleaming here and there ahead, I took a turn and met the fox, stock still, face to face in the middle of the road. Wildness tore through me as he dipped and wheeled in a level-running, tawny breakaway. Oh, neat head, fabled brush, and astonished eye, my blue Volkswagen flared into with morning.
Well, you don't have to be a Nobel Prize-winning poet to be blessed with such gifts. But as George Meredith wrote, prose can paint evening and moonlight, but poets are needed to sing the dawn. Most of us, as a rule, will be found still abed when dawn breaks. But we all have occasion to be up before the sun, now and then, be it for duty or pleasure. Of the latter, I could hardly forget climbing up from the sleeping city of Athens to watch dawn break over the Acropolis, or catching the milk train to Covent Garden Market to study the bustling activity of this extraordinary place and its protagonists, the 2,000 or so porters with their great baskets of fruit or vegetables on their heads. As Arthur Mee wrote,
baskets piled up on their heads as high as lampposts. They have basket-carrying competitions, and the champion must carry 25. There is humour here among them, and among the women, shelling peas in summer or walnuts in autumn. It's only a small number of people who find any glory in this market. But in the early hours of the morning, this higgledy-piggledy place is touched with beauty. Then it is a blaze of colour and filled with the scent of flowers, banks of lilies, stalls hidden with roses, and in due season, every English flower that blooms.
Small wonder, then, that the makers of the musical My Fair Lady should have set a famous scene here. For those of us of the older generations, Dawn may not hold the same fascination as it once did, but there's still the memory of those times far back in the careless years of youth when we danced until dawn. And even now, there's always the Dawn chorus. Although for poets, Dawn is said to be rosy-fingered, for the casual labourer of 19th-century England, it didn't always offer rosy prospects. As Thomas Hardy wrote in 1883 in an essay entitled The Dorsetshire Labourer.
He should be viewed when attending a wet, hiring fair at Candlemas in search of a new master. His natural cheerfulness bravely struggles against the weather and the incertitude. But as the day passes on and his clothes get wet through and he is still unhired, there does appear a factitiousness in the smile which, with a self-repressing manliness hardly to be found among any other class, he yet has ready when he encounters and talks with friends who have been more fortunate.
Hardy's labourer would not have been hired for a vineyard, of course, and the scene was a wet English February, not a scorching hot day in Palestine. But the uncertainty, the hazardous life, is the same. And here's a present-day hireling in this poem by Welshman R.S. Thomas.
Cars pass him by. He'll never own one. Men won't believe in him for this. Let them come into the hills and meet him wandering a road, fenced with rain, as I have now. The wind feathering his hair, the sky's ruins gutted with fire of the late sun, smouldering still. Nothing is his, neither the land nor the land's flocks. Hired to live on hills too lonely, sharing his hearth with cats and hens, he has lost all property but the grey ice of a face splintered by life's stone.
One of American poet Robert Frost's most famous poems is The Death of the Hired Man. Silas, described by one critic as an old, incompetent hired hand, shiftless and proud, has been found by the farmer's wife, fast asleep, huddled against the barn door. It's winter time, and she begs her husband to be kind to him.
When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back. I told him so last haying, didn't I? If he left then, I said, that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbour him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes always when I need him most. In haying time, when any help is scarce. In winter he comes back to us. I'm done. Where did you say he'd been?
He didn't say.
What did he say? Did he say anything?
But little.
Anything? Mary, confess he said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me.
Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge the poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect? He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Remember the boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth. He thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good, perhaps, to someone in the world. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk, and nothing to look backward to with pride, and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now and never any different. Frost's hired man is not the day labourer, but rather the seasonal worker. But his spirit is that of those whom Hardy calls the free labourers of the Middle Ages. A spirit which still exists today in the men and women who choose to live by casual labour, without ties, without commitments, despite every effort of the organized world of civilization to draw them into itself. And where do they fit into our parable? Probably they're the workers who are taken on at the 11th hour, not being as presentable, maybe, as those who were hired first. But the employer treats all the same, giving a full day's pay to the last as to the first. The 12-hour working day began at dawn and ended when the first stars appeared. At vintage time, it would have begun at 6 in the morning and ended at 6 in the evening. According to the law, the workman had to be paid the same evening, as we read in Deuteronomy.
You are not to exploit the hired servant who is poor and destitute, whether he is one of your brothers or a stranger who lives in your towns. You must pay him his wage each day, not allowing the sun to set before you do, for he is poor and anxious for it.
We might think this expression of the poor man's anxiety an explanation for the owner's treatment of all in like manner. But the parable, write the biblical experts, is to be interpreted this way.
It is the celebration of grace which goes beyond the merits of man. Its purpose is to enhance divine generosity, which goes further than the strict rules of justice. But there is a specific aspect which reflects the situation in which Christ's work takes place. Israel and the just are certainly rewarded for their commitment, but with them are rewarded also the publicans, the sinners and the outsiders who have been converted after their life of sin. The first and the last are all saved by the merciful love of God, which goes beyond the mere material calculation of the just deeds carried out.
Well, it all seems to boil down to the old familiar words, once again in Isaiah.
For my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways not your ways.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for her programme There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And you can hear the next episode in her weekly series next Sunday. It's time now to go arty, and the name of the artist in question is none other than Michelangelo, that genius of the Italian Renaissance period. Michelangelo served under no fewer than 7 popes, who commissioned plenty of sacred art for him to spend his life working on. Among those works was his towering masterpiece on the walls of the Sistine Chapel, the Last Judgment fresco, painted behind the chapel's altar. Our companion is Breda Ennis, Professor of Fine Arts in Rome, who takes us by the hand and gives us an insight both into Michelangelo's artwork itself and into the symbolism behind it. Veronica Scarsbrick accompanied Professor Ennis on her tour of the Sistine Chapel, where in this programme they focus their attention on the biblical figure of St. John the Baptist, who's among the hundreds of people depicted in Michelangelo's giant fresco.
Guido, we're still speaking about the last judgment. We didn't think we'd ever end somehow.
And we're if we did all 400 figures, we would be here for the next 2 years.
We're going to speak about a very important figure again today. Looking at the fresco, he's to the left of Christ.
Yes, yes.
And he's John the Baptist.
Yes. Looking as intense as he is described, in a sense, because a very intense figure and
a devilish face, in a way.
No, it's almost like it's severe more than devilish. No, he's very severe, but he's generally portrayed dressed in unkempt clothes and looking like a wild man from the desert. And looking very severe, which in fact he was. Yeah, because actually what he's trying to do is, no, more than that, he's trying to warn people, like, Messiah is coming. He's very near. So wake up, you people. This is the feeling you get from this figure. And it's lovely when you look at the eyes. I mean, he has a hooked nose. He's not exactly a fabulous-looking individual. He's not a beautiful-looking man, if you want to put it that way. But there was a wonderful expression in his eyes, though. Look, he's looking with an adoration at the figure of Christ the Judge in the middle. Because this was the content of his message, this was his role, and he's a very special man. He's celebrated on the 24th of June, which is his birthday, on the 29th of August as well, which was the day of his martyrdom. So he's the only saint, along with the Virgin Mary and Jesus, whose birthday is celebrated as a feast, an official church feast. All the others are celebrated on the day of their martyrdom or their death. And this is because he was sanctified already before his birth, because his actual birth was miraculous in a sense, and he prepared humanity for the coming of Christ.
So he's an in-between man. He's between the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yes, he's the last prophet from the Old Testament and the first one of the New. So he is a link.
The glue.
Well, yeah, more than that, it's almost like he clasps the two. He brings the two books together. More than even binding them, it's almost like he's putting some wonderful gold clip on the two of them to hold them together strongly. This is the feeling I always get.
That's a beautiful image.
He's a very, very important key figure in the linking of the two books. I mean, when I think of him in terms of the key figure, I'm jumping over also to St. Peter with his keys at the same thing. Because you always find some types of images that tend to float around certain figures. And he's one of these people.
Well, the way they're placed.
They're the two, let's say, they're standing straight up and the two strongest, more muscular figures in the Last Judgment fresco. Because the Christ figure, yes, it is a muscular one, but it's more refined. The figures of John the Baptist and Peter are stronger and more rugged, let's say. A little bit like Hercules, the statue of Hercules. So when people asked him who he was, St. John, he answered, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness." And you can actually feel the intensity of this in this face that you see here. And look, his arms are down by his sides. So it's almost like he understands that what he had to do was done. And of course, remember that Christ chose him to be baptized. So he was baptizing before the arrival of Christ. And then the real baptism, he had this wonderful gift that Christ chose him to be baptized in the River Jordan.
Rita, apart from this depiction of both St. Peter and St. John the Baptist in the Last Judgment fresco, these two figures appear elsewhere in the Sistine Chapel in a different manner.
You have the fresco on the lower part of the Sistine, where you have Peter receiving the keys from Christ. You also have the first fresco just to the right of the altar, where you see St. John the Baptist baptizing Christ. And again, in that fresco below, he's shown in his more classical garb, holding the long cross, standing with one foot on a rock and one foot in the water, and he's baptizing Christ. And he's wearing the robes that we normally associate him with. So again, it's a repetition here. He's repeated in the Sistine Chapel. So this also underlines the importance of his role. He sometimes holds a lamb, which has a cruciform nimbus, no? The lamb is one of his iconographical attributes, because he was the one who said, "Behold the Lamb of God." He's here to one side of Christ, and he's the person who brought the message to the people and brought the direct link to the Messiah who came. And on the other side, you have St. Peter, who received that message and brought it down into the Sistine Chapel for us. And this is why this link with the Pope is so terribly important, because you're coming through the prophets, through the revelation, which is an action. Obviously, here you have the judgment, but it's the judgment as the result of the revelation. And then on the right-hand side, you have Peter, who created, let's say, the earthly church. And then below that, you have the altar of the Pope.
Michelangelo was a very knowledgeable person about the church.
Well, yeah, not only knowledgeable, but he was also very religious. This is something people tend to forget. Because I think Michelangelo had this extraordinary capacity to immerse himself in what he was trying to paint. And trying to give the totality of his spiritual self to creating something that would give and inspire a message in the people who are observing for years to come.
And many thanks there to Veronica Scaresbrick for producing that programme featuring Breda Ennis, Professor of Fine Arts in Rome, during a tour of the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us here on Vatican Radio. And don't forget, you can listen to our programmes at any time by checking out our website on en.radiovaticana.va. That's en.radiovaticana.va. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus. Thank you.